From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harvard University has recently undergone an exodus of celebrity talent from its African-American Studies department. In this hour, we talk with Harvard professor Anthony Appiah about what the departure of the African-American Dream Team says about race and identity at Harvard and in America today. First, one of President Bush's closest aides, Karen Hughes, resigned today. Dana Milbank is White House correspondent with The Washington Post. I asked him, what's the reason for her leaving Washington?
The reason given is the one that everybody accepts and is certain is the case, and that is that this is strictly a matter of her husband and her son being very unhappy in Washington and very eager to return to Texas.
Simple as that.
It really is as simple as that. I mean, for anybody close to the situation to think that Karen Hughes would be pushed out or asked to leave, it's absolutely preposterous. And on its face, there's sort of nothing particularly wrong with the White House message machine. I mean, they have difficult weeks here and there, but you couldn't suggest that it's been anything other than successful.
Dana, on the West Wing, it's not supposed to happen like this. Karen Hughes is supposed to just buck up and hang in there with the president.
Well, it's interesting. She always talked about the difficulty of family, and she always made sure she left at 5:30 on Wednesday nights to spend some time with her son and got out of there at 7 o'clock on other nights, which certainly by White House standards is quite early. Apparently, even that wasn't working out very well, and the strain really became obviously too much.
Karen Hughes is described as the most influential woman ever to work on a White House staff, right up there in the top three, along with Chief of Staff Andrew Card and Senior Advisor Karl Rove. What has Karen Hughes' stamp on the Bush machine, the Bush White House, been?
Well, she's in charge of the message, and if you think about it, really the message has been the most successful component of this White House, is extraordinary discipline, the absence or very low level of leaks of information that they haven't authorized. It's sort of maddening to those of us covering it, but it's quite a feat of discipline. Typical of this was even her closest colleagues didn't know this till this morning. So, of course, the word wasn't going to leak out because the people who do the leaking didn't even know it.
And she's been key to the face of President Bush that the nation has come to know. It's been said that she's been key to enabling him to communicate his conservative views and values in a mainstream way. How has Karen Hughes done that? What's been her magic?
Well, she has a lot to do with his speeches. Obviously, they have a whole speech-writing staff, but she sort of is able to wrap the policies, many of which are quite conservative policies, in a very sort of warm and fuzzy blanket, and she understands Bush's way of speaking and cadence and is able to put a very happy face on virtually every issue in his agenda.
So how much of the George W. Bush that we've come to know has been Karen Hughes talking? How deep is her stamp?
Well, we're about to find out. You know, it's the sort of thing, they've known each other so well for so many years, and she, sort of an alter ego in a sense, that it's hard to tell whether she's creating him or she's merely reflecting him. Obviously, there's probably some of each. So the months ahead will tell us exactly how much she was creating him as opposed to reflecting him.
She's headed back to Texas with her husband and 15-year-old son. She says, I'm going to be changing the way in which I serve the president, that she'll still be on board. Bush says she'll still be in his inner circle. But is that really possible, the way Washington works?
Well, no, of course not. I mean, I'm sure they'll talk, and I'm sure she'll spend time at the ranch in Crawford. But the way it works there, it's all about FaceTime, and it's all about, who's the last guy or woman the president spoke to. She is one of just really three people who can just walk into the Oval Office whenever she wants and get an audience with the president. Now, obviously, when you've got to, lob in a call from Texas and you're not there at all the meetings, that you just don't have that same kind of influence.
There's been speculation that since September 11th and the rise of security issues, Hughes has been a bit marginalized. And then there have been some maybe crossed wires and mixed messages in the White House on Middle East policy, on the coup in Venezuela. Is there evidence that she's been at all sidelined since the September 11th attacks?
I really don't think so. Obviously, the foreign policy and military advisors take on greater prominence in this time. But she's been in on these same meetings to an extraordinary extent for a communications advisor. So I'd be pretty skeptical of some notion that she'd become irrelevant. I think that would be the wrong way to look at this.
And Dana, how big a blow to George W. is this? What has her relationship with him been?
Well, it's got to be difficult because it's the only person besides his wife in that entire building who really sort of understands him and sort of intuitively knows what he's thinking and can put his ideas into speeches and events and that sort of thing. So I imagine in a personal sense that's very hard. Whether it'll have any effect that all of us can see on the outside, that's the big question. It'll take many months to figure that out.
Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. In January, Anthony Appiah's decision to leave Harvard's African American Studies Department for Princeton made front-page news in the New York Times. Now, his famous colleague Cornel West is also leaving the university for greener academic pastures after a bitter falling out with Harvard. Superdon Henry Louis Gates remains, but the days of Harvard's African American Dream Team are done. The discipline of African American Studies has historically been where academics have tackled serious issues of race and identity. But the field has not been without its growing pains and has been fertile ground for cultural debate. In the wake of the shakeout in Harvard's African American Studies Department, how are we thinking about race relations in the country today? What can we learn from a Dream Team's demise about race in America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Anthony Appiah. He is, for the moment, professor of philosophy and African American studies at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Appiah.
Hi.
Good to have you. Also with us tonight from Providence is guest analyst Lewis Gordon, chair of the African American Studies Department at Brown University. Hello, Lewis Gordon.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Real well. Thanks for being with us. Anthony Appiah, it's been a wild season at Harvard. I don't know, as bright and shining a department as you had there, perhaps it never had as much ink in the press as it's had over the last 6 months, as it came apart. We want to look tonight at what this dream team meant, or this concentration, or this even just this focus on an African American Studies department meant in terms of American society, in terms of African Americans, in terms of all understanding Americans' understanding of race, and what its breakup signifies. If anything, what's your sense sitting here tonight? You've given your notice. Cornel West has given his. What's the moment that's produced this beyond the personal issues involved? And we know there are those.
I think that the trouble with talking to philosophers is that they're always going to question the presuppositions of any question.
Well, but we expect no less of you.
So let me just say that I think that what's interesting about what happened in African American Studies over the past few years at Harvard is what made it possible, not what it made possible. I think the insofar as it signals anything, it signals something about the work of scholars and students in many places, many departments, and some people outside the university in shaping the field of African and African American studies and making it, as it were, plausible as a field for a study at one of America's great institutions. Of higher learning. And I think that's the significant thing.
Well, that may take us right to the heart of this. So in that sense, is the busting up of the Dream Team a sign of a retreat by African American studies, or is it a sign of a coming of age? People can be anywhere, go anywhere. There's a vibrant conversation going on. You don't need to have this emblematic concentration at one university.
Yes. I don't think we ever did need the emblematic concentration. And I always felt myself a bit uncomfortable with all this talk about dream teams and so on. I think one of the things that's different between basketball and the academy is that a good department and a great department is the work of many individual people, mostly working on their own with students and interacting with each other. It's not like there's somebody who has to actually put the ball in the net at the end of each class. Each of us puts the ball in the net at the end of each of our own classes. So I think that I think also it would be a mistake to think of what's happened as signifying the end of anything. There's a terrific continuing concentration of scholars working in African American studies at Harvard, and I should again remind people that it includes both black and white scholars, and the students in the department, the graduate students and the undergraduate students are white and black and yellow and brown, and that I think in a certain sense it does represent a good situation in the sense that a strong department, like a strong department of philosophy or a strong department of sociology, people come, people go, and it stays strong. Mm. New people will be coming to Harvard. Michael Dawson, the chairman of the political science department at Chicago, is coming next year. We've got a new young woman coming in literary studies from Berkeley. So I see the achievement of the last decade as a narrowish one, which is the achievement at Harvard of a strong department, which will survive the departure of two or three or four people, because two or three or four other people will come in.
Mm-hmm. But let us take it as a moment to look at this whole field, mm-hmm. African American studies, I guess, as a defined field, is maybe three decades and some on now. Where does the whole field of study find itself? Has it come into a clearer understanding and mission, or is it diversifying and becoming diffuse? How do you see the very kind of mission or definition of African American studies now?
I think there's a sort of divide among people who work in what is called African American studies between those who think of what they're doing as the development of a new kind of discipline among disciplines, drawing on history, sociology, literary studies, philosophy, anthropology, and so on, and others like myself who think of it as an interdisciplinary field where people come with their trainings in various disciplines, philosophy, anthropology, and so on, to a common conversation. And I think the two major conversations that there are conversations about race and public policy and conversations about African-American culture in the broadest sense, literature, intellectual life, philosophy, popular culture, music, art, mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. And we've tried to do both of these at Harvard. Some departments have focused more on the social policy end. Some other departments have focused more on the sort of cultural, the broadly speaking cultural studies end. Both, I think, are important conversations. I think you can have a fine department that does just one of them. And I think that they're very important conversations because they feed into the broader conversations mm-hmm. of other disciplines.
Lewis Gordon, jump in here with us. We have the sense at Harvard that certainly in Cornel West's case, that it was in part his work outside of academe that got him in a tussle with the administration at Harvard. Is or was that an inevitable conflict of these kind of two roles for African American studies that Anthony Appiah is describing here?
Well, in many ways, Cornel West's experience, at least as it's been reported in the press, mm-hmm. exemplifies many of the anxieties over race issues in the country. It's clear that a form of double standard was, at least it looked like it, was being placed on Professor West. Professor West, like many, many scholars, he has his academic life, and he also has what he does in his, in the community. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, what he does, whether it be as a person who exemplifies a great deal of civic duty or as a person who tries his aesthetic outlets, I doubt it was the case that he was presenting those for his assessment of his year's activities as a scholar. I'm a jazz musician, for instance. I don't present that for that.
Right.
But the idea that, there's another subtext to this, of course, and which is that there's this, what many people were talking about at the time was his relationship with Al Sharpton. And in many ways, there's a sense in which, at least outside of, I'm not in privy to the conversation, but outside of that context, that there's a sense in which when one is playing at least a role of a race representative, there's a sense in which some institutions try to dictate what the terms of that representation may be.
Mm-hmm. Made to order kind of terms.
Made to order. Well, it taps into some other issues. I mean, for instance, it depends on what press one reads, how the group at Harvard is portrayed. I agree with Professor Appiah that some of the things that are missing, for instance, is the multiracial dimension of that department. There are complicated issues in terms of the analogies around dream teams when you're talking about the academy. Mm-hmm. But there's a deeper issue that goes into the history of race relations in the United States, and that is that black scholars have never exclusively had the luxury or to play the role simply as scholars. If we think about the days of Booker T. Washington, the power wielded by the Tuskegee machine, mm-hmm. and how throughout the history of this kind of politics, there has been this kind of race representative.
There's a public role required there. We're talking tonight with Anthony Appiah of Harvard, soon to be of Princeton, and with our guest analyst, Lewis Gordon from Brown University, about the breaking up of Harvard's African American Studies Dream Team and what it means. Is the shakeup a tempest in an ivory teapot, or is there a larger significance here? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Anthony Appiah about race, identity, and academe. What impact does academe have on race relations in America? And do the royalty of academia affect race relations on the street, in the workplace, in your life? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you feel the stars of academia in African American studies pushing racial progress? What is racial progress in your mind? Anthony Appiah, take us back for a minute. What were people hoping would grow out of the African American studies, the movement to have these departments when they were first implemented around the country? And how close have we come to realizing what people were hoping for?
I think, like many products of a sort of vast social movement, and we have to remember that African American studies, black studies in general, grew out of the social movements of the late 60s with takeovers of you know, administration and offices at universities and so on. There were many ambitions. I think in many places the ambition was simply to have important questions about African American and African cultures and civilizations represented as topics of study and conversation and research at major institutions. But I think because the people who were active in the campaigns for this were often themselves social activists, mm-hmm. there was a tendency to think that while that was important, it was even more important to structure new kinds of department that had a role both as centers of scholarship and as centers of sort of activism and relationship between the university and what's called the community. Mm-hmm. And many departments continue to have that sense of themselves as having these multiple functions, as a center of scholarship, as a center of social activism, and as a center of relationship with the local black community. Mm.
And that seems, by some interpretations, to have come up in at least Cornel West's departure from Harvard. What's your sense there? One can well understand how people would want to see some social activist role from black academic leaders. At the same time, has this led to African American studies being seen as a kind of stepchild or second-class department because it wasn't entirely fixated, as most university departments are, on purely the academic pursuit?
Well, I think it's fair to say that while many of us in our individual lives have been doing things in various communities in various ways, the department has thought of itself, and I think Cornell would join in this, as fundamentally an academic department whose standards are academic standards and whose major function as a department is to be a center for research, a center for the education of students, both graduate and undergraduate, and a point of connection between academics interested in topics to do with race and African-American history and culture in the other parts of the university. And I think, you know, to the extent that we've succeeded, I think we've succeeded because we have strong, intellectually stimulating conversations with our colleagues in sociology, in English, in history, and in the government department and so on, and also with colleagues in the law school and mm-hmm. Kennedy School, and that we have fine students. So I think our model has been perhaps to show that out of the movement for African American studies, it's been possible to develop a strong interdisciplinary field, which is an important part of the intellectual conversation, the academic conversation in the American Academy. The other sides of people's activities, whether it's campaigning with
Al Sharpton.
Al Sharpton or Bill Bradley, which mm-hmm. for whom he also campaigned,
mm-hmm. Very
or
much.
Or whether it's Skip Gates and me working together to develop the Martin Luther King after school program in Dorchester, which is now going to go on in Baltimore as well. I mean, these are all things that people do. People at all kinds of corporations, all kinds of institutions,
yeah,
do that.
But
kind of work.
We don't want to speak for Cornel West, but it sure appears that he went away feeling that his work was not entirely respected. Not respected in the way that could leave him not taking some offense at the tenor of the conversation and perhaps some of the faculty response around it. Lewis Gordon, help me out here. You've watched this, I'm sure, with great interest from down the pike at Brown. Well, are there still issues of in Cornel West's words, I guess, respect that surround African-American studies, and why?
Well, one of the things that, for me, really raised some questions was not the question of Cornel West himself, but also some of the ugly behavior of various members of the white faculty at Harvard around this issue. And this taps into something that's a little deeper. Some of the questions around plausibility and respect also connect to issues of recognition. And one faces the complicated question on whose terms will one build one's research. Mm-hmm. In many ways, for instance, there are individuals for whom anything that is connected with things labeled black or African are patently inferior to things that are not. And in a situation like that, in spite of all the accolades, in spite of all the T's being crossed and the I's being dotted, there's always this element that would be in which that kind of achievement would be denigrated. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the internal questions, I think there are deeper questions in terms of how African American studies relates to African American studies. In other words, the modes of assessment beyond the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or people who don't really know the field. Mm-hmm. Using their often, in my view, very arrogant modes of assessment. Because could you imagine if for the most part, people who don't know anything about Kant philosophy or physics mm-hmm. Taking upon themselves so casually and often flippantly to make the judgments that they do make, that's a sign of a very racially hostile situation.
To blithely hand those down. How about it, Anthony Appiah? Do you feel that a kind of patronizing, easy judgment going on around what goes on in this area?
Well, I think we should distinguish between how we're to interpret the remarks and actions of one person, the president of Harvard University, mm-hmm. which I think myself is relatively less important. Larry Summers, than the broader question of how as Professor Gordon says, of how the how this event played out in the wider culture. I don't know how to interpret what Larry Summers did, so I'm not going to try. Mm-hmm. But I do think that what Professor Gordon says is completely correct. That is that here is someone who has all the right credentials, mm. who's one of the most cited scholars by people of all races in the social sciences, more highly cited than many other university professors mm-hmm. at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that for people who write op-ed pages to feel that they are competent to assess the work of someone whom they apparently have not read, mm-hmm. against the evaluations of people in the field who declare his work seminal, useful, productive, mm-hmm. Is the sort of thing that doesn't go on in relation to other fields. It does go on in mm-hmm. relation to, I mean, in general, it goes on in relation to fields which deal with the sorts of identities that have been and continue to be to some extent historically derogated. So it goes on in relation to black studies, women's studies, gay studies.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, of course, that's your sort of foundation claim to fame is your highly acclaimed book of 20 years ago now, In My Father's House, Africa in the Philosophy of Culture.
Ten
years ago. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
I've been at this for 20 years.
My gosh, he's holding up well. Anyway, you posited there that race itself was a kind of a biological unreality, that it wasn't that it just didn't really matter. It was purely a construct. Have your years in African American studies, and I guess your years at Harvard, led you to see race as a larger or smaller factor in life and work and America?
I've always thought, and I continue to think, that attempts to understand race in biological terms are misguided intellectually. I think unsustainable, increasingly unsustainable in the face of evidence from things like the Human Genome Project. Mm-hmm. I think if I were to criticize that book myself, which I would not do with the vigor that some other people have, I would say, however, that though I did discuss the sort of the social reality of race as opposed to its biological unreality, and though I did say something about the positive roles of racial identities, I didn't probably say enough about that. So one of the things that I've been doing over the last decade, really, is thinking about the ways in which racial identity can be seen to be, as a result of the historical circumstances of the United States, potentially a positive force in the lives, at least of African Americans. That is, it's a source of, it can be a source of solidarity, it can be a source of meaning because it connects people to a history, to culture, to traditions. And I think to the while I've sort of always thought that, I think perhaps I didn't make it clear enough in the book that that was mm-hmm. that was part of the view. So yes, I would guess, and so I've spent time trying to reflect more on that positive side of racial identity, while at the same time continuing to think about the dangers of racial identity, the fact that something that can be a source of solidarity can also be a source of exclusions and unkindness and hostility.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Anthony Appiah of Harvard, soon to be of Princeton, about race, identity, and academia. Have 3 decades of African-American studies had an impact on race relations in the United States? And what do we lose when we lose an African-American dream team? Is it something vital or just an elite trifle? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Siddiqui's on the line. Welcome, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Well, let me just say that, you know, with all due respect to the dream team, the real question is, you know, dream team for whom? In terms of Cornel West, you know, like I've done some work with Cornel, and mm-hmm. he's a good brother, and I consider him to be a friend. But for me, the reality is that when you talk about the dream team and, quote unquote, I consider it to be African history, that in many instances, a lot of young black people are educated in schools here in this country, which basically are racist in terms of history. And that have no awareness, virtually no awareness in regards to, you know, from whence we came, we, you know, being the original civilization, what have you, mm-hmm. and are taught essentially that we came from slavery. Mm. So the issue for me is a dream team at historically black colleges is where you really need it. I mean, 85 to 90% of the college black college graduates in this country come from historically black colleges. So for me, I would like to see the dream team, you know, take the pay cut. And rather be at Harvard, go to Howard, mm-hmm. or rather than Princeton, be at Prairie View, because that's where, you know, I'm not really familiar with Professor Appiah, but I'm sure he's very confident, and I understand that, you know, has extensive history in terms of his abilities.
Yes, he does.
But the real value that I see of a quote-unquote dream team is to benefit young people of African descent who are in dire need of that type of education.
Mm-hmm. Siddiqui, it's a tough point. Let me put it right to Anthony Appiah, and here you get the expectations of society to someone in your position, Anthony Appiah, saying, hey, it's not enough for you to go off and be an academic at a beautiful elite institution. We need you educating, in this case, African-American youths. What about it? Would you be better off doing your work at Howard rather than Harvard, or in the public school system somehow rather than in the ivory tower? And I guess the larger question that comes out of what Siddiqui is asking is, are you and your, you know, colleagues in this field having an impact that gets right down to, in this case, the black American youths who need education and who need to understand their own cultural background?
Well, first, let me say first that I would defend the right of some of a black person, as of a white person, to be a scholar living in the academy and focused on their own scholarly work. I think that's an important role in our society, in our culture. It's also something that people are entitled to do, and they would be entitled to do it if it weren't an important role in our culture. And so I'm not going to say, I don't agree that everybody who has an interest in African American history and culture, for example, should immediately focus on the what I agree is a pressing need, which is to spread the truth and the results of 30 years of scholarship more broadly. I would say not just to African Americans, by the way, but to everybody. I think that one of the great problems in this country is not just that African Americans don't know enough about African American history and African history, but that people generally don't. Having said all that, I do have the worry that Siddiqui talks about, and so Professor Gates and I, as I said, have we developed the Africana Encyclopedia, mm-hmm. the Encarta Africana with Microsoft, mm-hmm. Which is now we made serious efforts going to foundations and other people to make sure that it got into schools all around the country, Chicago, San Francisco, Newark, Boston High School, Boston public school system. And we have developed curriculum for teachers to use in after-school programs to introduce this material to kids both in Dorchester and now in the city of Baltimore, which has made us part of their official after-school program. So, yes, these are important things. I believe that I can claim to have helped make a significant contribution to disseminating this. Mm. And I think that, but I return to my initial point. I think it's very important that it's just not fair to African-American scholars to make demands of them that you wouldn't make of other scholars. We all of us do our citizens' work and our public service in our own ways, and I don't think it's fair to say of a scholar who's doing terrific work in African American studies at Harvard, who is entitled to be at Harvard because he or she applied for a job there and met the standards and was the best candidate. I think it's unfair.
Mm-hmm. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Lewis Gordon, you hear the demand from the caller here to say, hey, let's get right down and help us out with the problems that are real and immediate. And yet, Anthony Appiah says, point taken, but black scholars also have the right to pursue the most rarefied themes they choose.
This question is posed to black scholars, and I would say white scholars who avow a certain activist profile tend to get that question, but it really points to some of what we were talking about earlier, the presumption that by virtue of being a black scholar, one necessarily must be an activist. Mm-hmm. The more complicated issue is really connected also to certain confusions outside of the academy in terms of how academic institutions are structured and how they function. For instance, we have some institutions are known as teaching institutions and some are more research institutions. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, the demands in a teaching institution are such that they can have an impact on the time available for research. The reality also is some people who are great researchers and may achieve fame for that are not necessarily the best teachers. It's not necessarily the case that if one is a research star, that one will be the best person to be teaching someone in a teaching institution, and also all the variety of sets of needs that are there. So even though it sounds good to say you pick the hottest scholars and you just put them into institutions with students who are facing many challenges in the society, in many ways that could be a recipe for great harm. Mm-hmm. And what we should do is to try to set up circumstances in which people, given the unique talents they have, it can bring that excellence to the students and also deal with a more complicated question, which is that knowledge is something that's very valuable in the society. And we have taken a position, at least many of us who are academics, that what we have to produce, what we have to offer our community and the world is something that represents at least some message from this generation that will be available to the next.
Amen.
Amen for that. We're talking with Anthony Appiah about race, identity, and academia. Is the fracas at Harvard about race, about racism, or just about tried and true university politics? And should African American studies be aimed at improving African American life, improving American life? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Anthony Appiah of Harvard University's Dispersing African American Studies Dream Team about race, identity, and academia. Have 3 decades of African American studies had an impact on race relations, and should they? Do you feel the stars of academia pushing real racial progress in America? And what is racial progress anyway? We're also joined tonight by Lewis Gordon. He's chairman of the African American Studies Department at Brown University. And right now, by Paul. Paul, welcome. You're on the line.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just have a question about the feeling that traditional academics are denigrating African American studies because it's about race or because it's about black people. And my concern is that isn't that skepticism about interdisciplinarity or at least trying to make disciplines focus on a specific group, whether it's regional or ethnic, whether it's African American studies or Asian American studies,
mm-hmm.
that there is genuine skepticism in the academy, and that it isn't all about black issues. It's just maybe a healthy skepticism of making sure that we're not just creating new disciplines because it's somebody's personal, you know, interest.
Right. And for that matter, about plain old American studies, it's a good question, Paul. How about it, Anthony Appiah? Do you feel that this is just a kind of headwind that all interdisciplinary studies run into at one point or another, and that there's not a racial element to it?
Oh, I don't think I've said that there was a racial element to it. I mean, I think there's a racial element, I think, to some of the response from outside the academy. But I think that, first of all, I should say that there is a huge amount of support for this sort of activity within the academy at Harvard and elsewhere. So it's not like everybody's against it. And second, that I agree that there is, I think, reasonable interest in the question of the solidity of interdisciplinary programs of all sorts. Yeah. I would say, however, that a lot of that skepticism comes from people who may not have thought as deeply as they might have about what a discipline is and what disciplines are. There are many departments in the university which study groups of questions which were put together at a certain point as a set of responses to particular historical moments, and which go on studying them, and within that rubric sort of develop slowly and change over the years. And there's no special naturalness to the questions that are brought together. I mean, English departments nowadays don't just study literature. They have people who study film. They have people who study popular media and so on. I think that's fine. But if you said to somebody, well, what defines an English department nowadays, I think you'd find it hard to say exactly. And that's fine, too. Yeah. So I don't know that we're in that people who work in an interdisciplinary field like African-American studies are in any worse shape in terms of being able to give a good answer to the question, what makes it all hang together, than people are in many fields. Mm. And as long as you ask sensible questions and give disciplined answers to them, drawing on reliable intellectual tools, I think that's fine. Mm.
Sheila's on the line. Welcome, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hi, Sheila. Well, thanks.
Good evening to Professor Gordon and also to Anthony. Anthony, this is Sheila Sinclair.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
I've been listening with, of course, great interest and sadness, because I won't be hearing your oh-so-elegant tones in the future. But it's made me think, this whole sort of dust-up at Harvard has made me think about the fact that perhaps this denigration of a primarily humanistic endeavor and the tradition of sort of dealing in matters outside of academia, that this whole tradition is coming into question, and it may be a harbinger of bad things to come.
You mean humanism is on the outs and the sciences are over all these days, Sheila? Is that your point?
Very good, Tom.
Well, thank you, Sheila. How about it, Anthony Appiah? And thank you, Sheila, for your call.
Again, let me distinguish between particular points about Harvard, which I don't feel particularly competent to comment on what's going to happen at Harvard. We have a new president. I don't know what he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's right that in the broader academy, there is evidence of a focus actually in two directions away from things that I think universities ought to do. One is something of a trend away from proper support for the humanities. I think the other is a trend away from pure science, pure research, and towards applied research, and towards things that have a quicker payback in the short term, away from, as it were, economic theory and towards business, away from fundamental research in the life sciences towards biotechnology. And I would only say that on the one hand, we still have, I believe, the best university system in the world in this country. We have wonderful universities, great research institutions. But on the other, there is a risk that if we don't continue to support the deep fundamental rethinking, all the other stuff will in the end sort of be worthless and less able to provide us with a rich intellectual life.
Take us back to your heartland ground there then for a minute, because we only have you for a couple of minutes more. Fundamental thinking that you've done on race and identity. We're often told, even now, and especially now, that race remains the number one issue or problem in America. What do you see as the most important question on race now? It's your bailiwick. What's central? What's most critical right now?
Well, I do. My answer to that question is not a question that relates very much to my own work. I believe that one of the fundamental difficulties facing our society at the moment continues to be that we have large areas of social life which are effectively segregated. We have large segments of the black population that see very few white people, and we have large segments of the white population that see in their everyday lives and in their schools very few black people. And
even large segments on integrated college campuses.
Absolutely. People can be side by side, but they're not interacting, they're not living together, they're not engaging in common productive activities. And you know, one of the things that is, I find this weird to find myself saying this because I'm not a great fan of the military in general, but one of the things about the United States military, for example, is it's an integrated institution in which black and white people have to depend upon each other, work together. White people have to take orders from black people have to take orders from white people. And I've often said, and I believe it to be true, that the average white person who comes into the United States military is likely to come out less racist than the average person from his or her background, and the average black person is likely to come out better able to deal on terms of equality with white people than the average person of that. So I think we should be thinking about how to stop living in segregated communities which produce segregated schools, which mean that the first time many people live together in communities of sort of trust and relationship across races in this country tends to be when they get to college, which is too late.
Mm. Lewis Gordon, we've only got half a minute left, but are African-American studies going to push us toward that more truly integrated life that Anthony Appiah is talking about, or pull us apart?
I think African-American studies has already done a lot of contributions beyond simply the question of race. The caller earlier brought up questions about disciplines, but the truth of the matter is there have been French studies, German studies, and none of them have occasioned the anxieties for dealing with the problems of our society and also the problems of knowledge, as African-American studies have. There are many fields have been affected. The very language of how many fields are beginning to look at some of the central questions in them have been affected by African-American studies. And what I would argue is that what African-American studies has stimulated and fought against as well in the society is the society's anti-intellectualism, its antipathy to thinking. In many ways, right now what we need, I would say, is a fundamental question, is a renewed effort to bring thinking back to the society.
We'll vote for that. Lewis Gordon, thanks for being with us this hour. And Anthony Appiah, thank you so much for coming in, and good luck as your trail takes you onward.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Check out the latest news from around the world. It's on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. In a moment, listening for the sound of the new New York. New York, New York, New York State of Mind, How About You, and any number of Gershwin tunes. These are some of the many songs that helped define New York City. But when the city changed so quickly on September 11th, some felt the songs should change with it. The editors of the Village Voice called on musicians to write songs in response to the destruction of the World Trade Center. The result is a new CD called Love Songs for New York. It's a benefit for the September 11th Fund. Doug Simmons is managing editor of the Village Voice. In this diary, he talks about trying to find new sounds for a new city.
This song's about how much we love New York.
Love Songs for New York was inspired by the events of September 11th, after the tragedy struck the World Trade Center, like many New Yorkers, the people at the Village Voice wanted to just figure out how to respond, do something original and truly useful. And we came up with the idea to put full-page ads in the paper inviting musicians and bands to send songs in to try to deal with the tragedy and to come to terms with it. We wanted to be sure to create a forum for a range of responses. I guess particularly defiance and anger. And in the ad, we asked people to think about what they were going to do when they sat down and wrote these songs and try to explore various ways of feeling and dealing with the issue. So that's one of the things when we pull together the 18 songs. We have raves, we have rap songs, straight-ahead folk songs, celebrations, just flat-out hard rock celebrations of the city, and some obviously some mourning and more tender songs. So we wanted to have just a breadth of emotions. We were looking for a sonic representation of the entire city, and even 18 songs can't really do justice to all of the music you might hear in New York, but that's what we were going for.
So I started out on High Street.
I hear several versions of New York. I hear the Washington Square, sunny afternoon New York of folk singers with their acoustic guitars sitting cross-legged on the grass.
Now you have to take the A-train. There's no more service on the sea.
And then, we're delighted to have Afrika Bambaataa's Lay Down Candles in the Rain, and that was inspired by the candle tributes that were built in Union Square shortly after the tragedy. Two songs really jump out for me. Andrew WK's I Love New York City.
I love New York City. Oh, yeah. New York City.
Which is just a big 4/4 booming hard rock song that I can imagine being played at the loudspeakers at Yankee Stadium or at a Knicks game. And the Mekons' I Love an Apple. You could hear it at the stage at CBGB's on any given weekend, and it's sort of a tour of the Lower East Side and all the grime and punkiness of New York City. Those are my two favorites. By putting the call out for original songs and asking people to write songs to address the tragedy, that we would be perhaps giving one of the best contributions of all if we can inspire people to come up with new songs. And I think we did that. I think a lot of these are the kind of things that are going to be played, I hope, for years. It'd be nice to see a standard arise from the project to match Frank and Liza's New York, New York, or certainly one of the Ramones anthems. But that's what we're aiming for, hoping to get people just to write inspired, loving music for New York City.
Doug Simmons is managing editor of The Village Voice. The CD is called Love Songs for New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...